Welcome to Going Beyond Medicine with Elaine Grohman. Conversations with people who are working to make a difference in our world. Now here's your host for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon. This is Elaine Grohman. And as you know, the show is called Going Beyond Medicine. And I'm always very grateful and I feel very fortunate to be able to bring leaders, thought leaders, individuals that are doing extraordinary work to help us look at ourselves differently, to look at what medicine means. Medicine is not just a pharmaceutical. Medicine is change. Medicine is things that are bringing together good, healthy change to our planet. And I'm really honored today to be able to speak and bring to you, to the listening audience, a young, beautiful woman named Nicole Fisher, who I had the pleasure to meet a couple of years ago. Nicole Fisher is a senior policy advisor on Capitol Hill and is an expert on health innovation, economics, technology, and reform, specifically as it impacts vulnerable populations. She is the founder and CEO of Health and Human Rights Strategies in Washington, D.C. And without further ado, I want to get to a discussion right away. So welcome to the show, Nicole. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
So please tell us about a little bit about yourself and how you got to be in this position that you are. And then I want to talk about your company and the work that you're doing with health and human rights strategies. And then later on in the show, we can talk about brain health and the importance of what you're doing there.
Yes. Well, that's very exciting. We have a few things to cover. So you said a little bit about me. I guess from the very beginning, I grew up in the South. I was actually born in Louisiana, but my family moved around quite a bit. And all the men in my family were first responders, firemen, actually. And everyone else in my family was a small business owner. I come from a very creative family. Mm. And I was the first person to say, I want to go to college. And so I took that a bit further. I went to college and then I got a master's degree and I'm right now a few months away from finishing my doctorate. And
congratulations.
You know, thank you. It's been a long path.
Yes.
Longer than it probably should have been. But, you know, what's really nice is to be able to bring that entrepreneurship sort of background and that I brought up, you know, my family, the men in my family, my dad in particular, being first responders. And I love that sort of frame of always helping people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like just being a doctor, which is what I thought I wanted to be when I was young. And then I thought, you know, there's a lot more than treating a patient in a hospital or writing a prescription. You know, taking care of people is a lot of different things. And it's done many different ways. And so I've finally, several years ago, after working for government, and I had a great fellowship, I took some time and really thought about how do I want to help people? And I finally decided I want to change the system. And as you know, the healthcare system is far more than just what we in America think of as oftentimes just insurance, right? You get an insurance card, you go see a doctor. I thought that's absolutely silly. No other country in the world does it the way we do it. And even in communities in our own country, that's not at all the way people think of care. And so to me, I started thinking about what is healthcare? Well, it's housing, it's transit, it's your education, it's the community around you, it's your family, it's the food you eat, it's all of these things. And so I've tried really hard in the last few years of running my business to really merge, health and taking care of people with the community and the things we access around us. And it's fun. It makes certain that no 2 days look alike.
Well, you know, and it's so wise and it just makes sense, Nicole. And thank you for what you do because, you know, we often in our culture, we think about health when it's challenged, when it's been impacted mm-hmm. in a dramatic way, whether through trauma or illness. But we forget often that what we do every single day, how we care for ourselves, how we care for our environment, the foods we eat, the shelter we have is truly health care, caring for our health. So
yes.
Thank you for what you do. And as a result of that, you really get to help people think differently about how they view themselves. Would you agree?
I would agree. Although, I certainly can't take the credit. In many cases, it's conversations like this one. Mm-hmm. The moment people have it put in front of them, most people get it right away.
Yes.
And they recognize how much, even if it's someone, it's silly, and a silly example, even if it's someone complaining about their 2-hour commute to and from work and then sitting in an office, the moment you start talking about their environment and what the toll that takes on them, it goes far beyond, oh, it's stressful. You start hearing about things as, well, I've missed so much of my child's activities. It's actually causing all this strain on, fill in the blank. And it's like people get it really quickly that everything they do and touch impacts their health. And yet we can't seem to get policy, at least here in D.C., so much of policy. We just can't seem to get it to that recognition point of changing the systems.
I'm glad that you said that, Nicole. What do you think is the real barrier that's preventing people from looking at what is so blatantly obvious, especially on Capitol Hill? And it's amazing that you are a senior policy advisor. So there's obviously you help people to reflect differently, or you wouldn't be an advisor at all. And I appreciate that about you. And what do you think is the big barrier that people, are they afraid of changing? Are they afraid of, what do you think it is?
Well, I'd be lying if I said anything other than I don't know. I think change is hard. That is part of it, especially when our system is one where, for better or worse, everything is tied to budgets and to legislation. And people who are elected, there are people who help them get there and they owe favors. And that is part of the system.
Yes.
And so therefore making change in that system is exceptionally difficult. The other side, I think there's a phrase that I certainly cannot take credit for, but I do use, and I've heard other people say it, and it's health in all policies. And it's thinking about healthcare in everything. And so when someone's working on a transportation issue or a housing HUD, for housing and urban development, when that agency is thinking about housing, they should be thinking about health, health in all the policies that they're making. Mm. And yet I could be wrong, but I would argue part of the problem is that it's overwhelming. When you start to think about, deconstructing and reconstructing subsidies for housing or where people can live or how kids get bused to a school, it's like that's hard enough. We already struggle enough to get it done and to pay for it. Adding in, well, how do people think about it or feel about it? Or, there are 2 or 3 children in this neighborhood who are being left out of it. I think it's adding on layers of, oh no, we're barely keeping it together as is. How do we add in all this other complexity? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a shame, but I think people, they hear it, they recognize it again at the individual level, and then they look at the broader policy and they go, well, we can only do a few things. We know we can do these. We don't know how to get to those.
Right.
And because we call it health, they can push it off onto someone else.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because we have been taught to hold on to the things that we know rather than really being taught to have the joy and the adventure of learning how to think differently. And when we learn how to think differently, then we can kind of let all of the monkey that's been on our back or the cultural beliefs start to lose so much of their ability to make us be in straitjackets. You know what I'm saying? It's really an interesting thing that how humans are so afraid of change, but it's what we're here to do. We're here to change.
Yeah. Go
ahead, please.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, I think you're exactly right. And when you think about that in the context of we were just talking about like changing policy, it's really fascinating to think about the political dynamic of the country right now.
Yes.
And it's like people are afraid of change inherently, despite the fact, your point, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And then you add in all these people who in the past have gotten along. And that's something I always loved about D.C. There are many things not to love about D.C. But one of the things I did always love was that two people could debate something beyond, as we call it, opposite sides of the aisle, mm-hmm. you know, stand up, make public statements, literally go head to head, completely disagree, and you could see them having dinner or a drink after. And they had this mutual understanding of something has to get done. You know, I have to do a little bit of grandstanding, but at the same time, like, we're going to compromise somewhere in the middle. And if we're not, then I'm going to get my way on this thing. But next time on the next issue, you know, you guys are going to have your say. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoyed seeing this sort of, you know, there's a public display of disagreement, but behind closed doors, people were really working together. That is less the case now. And so as we talk about our comfort zones and change, it has been really, like, I actually was asked a while back on stage, someone caught me off guard and they said, what are you most looking forward to with this administration? And I thought for a little bit and I said, the books that will be written. And I was really serious though. I said, in 5 to 10 years, the books that are written about the last several years of politics are going to be fascinating because we've had a real shift in that ability to get along and to be bipartisan or to go have a drink after a debate and talk things out. And that is, unfortunately, a change we have seen here in D.C., and it's not helping the healthcare system or any of the systems that impact health get better.
Right. And I think that, you know, from the perspective that I try to bring things, you know, broaden the perspective from ancient knowledge of what was called the medicine wheels and Native American understanding and in our indigenous cultures that understood we had to do what's called speak across the fire, which meant that your words would hold the test of time. They would hold being forged in fire, which is a whole other thing that we can talk about at another time because it's a really big thing. But what's so intriguing to me, as you said, about what will we talk about in the future? How will we, would this time be chronicled? And in a way, I think that we can easily get caught up in the challenges that we see. But if there is a good thing about what's happening is all of our misgivings and all of the ways that we've cloaked things, perhaps in the past, are being totally exposed. So we have to. It's a gift in a way. That we could see what isn't working, because it cannot be held behind closed doors anymore. So I think that that's a good perspective, or perhaps a new perspective to look at it is, oh gosh, maybe this is a good thing that we're seeing all of this dysfunction.
Sure, that's very true. Yeah. And as you said, you know, by coming to this point and there being a lot of exposing and a lot of, especially for our country, a lot of self-reflection, once those conversations start, I mean, you're opening up all new doors and they can't be undone.
That's right.
And so that's actually, thank you. That's a very nice way of thinking about the day-to-day chaos around here.
Again, my guest is Nicole Fisher, and she is the founder and the CEO of Health and Human Rights Strategies in Washington, D.C. And she is a senior policy advisor on Capitol Hill and is really working all over the globe, really, to help people understand what health innovation is and how it is tied to economics and technology and reform. So I love on you. I've just been absorbing your website so much, Nicole. I really appreciate how clear it is. And I love the fact that you talk about that you curate a monthly international dinner series called A Seat at the Table, bringing together thought leaders and officials off the record to talk about policy and planning. What a brilliant idea. How did you come up? It must have been because you're Irish, Dolly. Bring everybody around the table. Let's talk about this business.
Well, and actually, you are one of the couple people that know. I'm a mutt, which we all are at this point. But so the things, my heritage that comes together actually informs the way I think. But there's that part. But then there's also, as you talked about, you know, like thinking about wheels and, even my high school and my elementary school, I was a Cherokee Indian.
Yes.
Throughout my tenure at the schooling system as well. And so A Seat at the Table is a fun side hustle. But you know, the best things come from your passions. And how that came to be, again, you know, lots of people get lots of credit for this, was originally years ago in D.C., it was coffee. And it was a few of us around when the Affordable Care Act was passing, we'd get together and we'd talk. And it wasn't about selling each other secrets. It was more like, we're sort of the next generation. We have got to get some things done. You know, what the hell is going on over there? Mm-hmm. And so we'd all share a little bit of information, and it had to be obviously completely off the record. And we'd start talking about some of these broader things that you and I talk about, you know, doing good and helping people, and it doesn't look just like the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Like, well, if this piece falls apart, how are we going to, you know, plug a hole over there? And so it started with that, and then I moved to Chicago. And I have a very dear friend, and he and I did our master's degrees together at the University of Chicago. And Jacob is his name, and he thinks very differently than I do. But he works in healthcare. He has a master's in public policy as well, and he has an MBA. And so he very much thinks about sales and finance and but global health as well. And so we would have these debates. And so he and I, when we joined forces, decided to take this thing to the next level.
Mm.
And we started curating in Chicago a dinner series. And we would take a problem in the city of Chicago and we'd try and solve it. And we kept it off the record, invitation only. 20 people we found was our sweet spot, you know, that gives you over dinner enough time that everyone can feel at ease and speak, and yet no one can have the platform and run the show. And the goal became to invite 20 different people who touch whatever topic it was in completely different ways. Mm-hmm. And we had multiple people at every dinner say, I don't know why I'm here. And we'd say, but we do. And so we would do, you know, we'd eat, we'd drink, we'd talk, and it was just, and so much enjoyment came out of trying to solve problems. And what we found is that before long, I would have hospital CEOs calling and saying, well, you should invite me because of this, this, and this, and I'll send you my resume. And I said, well, we already have a hospital CEO. Like, well, but I'm better because of this. And I realized when you've got these very egotistical, and in the case of when I did this one in particular, I think it was six men, all hospital CEOs, all had MBAs, all were probably 60 some years old, all competing via calls and email to be the one who was chosen to come to dinner. Mm. And I went, we have a thing. We have a real thing here. We have grown men with big egos competing to be the person invited. And so we knew that we were on to something important.
Yes.
Because people with voices wanted to attend and they wanted us to choose them. And so we decided to use that actually to our advantage and say, well, you know, next time we'll come to you. Help us solve a problem in your community. And so we have attempted at this point to tackle everything from, you know, the stuff I did not enjoy, which is like payment reimbursement, all the way to the problems I absolutely love solving or helping to think about, which are like global security.
Mm.
We did a fascinating dinner on really we'd call it biosecurity. And we had, say, a pastor from the south side of Chicago sitting next to the guy who runs the Twitter feed for CDC, next to an infectious disease military specialist. And the point of that kind of thing is to get the guy who messages on behalf of the Centers for Disease Control in 140 characters to talk to a woman from the south side of Chicago whose congregants don't care what the CDC is issuing on behalf, right? And to say, how do we get your community to talk?
Mm.
And then the military person, and you know, imparts this wisdom of, he said, you know, we all have the same problem here. It's timeliness versus correctness. When do we share certain information with people and how do we communicate it? And then it was just like the whole room opened up and everyone figured out that they were all having the same conversation, just with different words and different discussions.
Mm.
And so the whole dinner around biosecurity became, when do you know and when do you tell people and how do you tell them?
Isn't that brilliant? And the beautiful mm-hmm. thing about what you've done here, Nicole, is that you've offered discussion, that you've offered the opportunity for people to mingle that maybe never would. And
yes.
isn't that what conversation really is? You know, rather than having it be a debate where someone is staunchly, you know, trying to yes. get their point across, it's a whole different thing when you have open communication and the opportunity to learn something new. That's
it's
brilliant.
Glorious.
I want to come to one of them.
you should. It is so fun. I really mean that word. Like, because what Jacob and I will do, especially because we're so different, we will speak to people we don't know, because we get recommendations all the time.
Sure.
And so, like with you as an example, I would say, Jake, I know her very well. Why don't you spend 10 minutes on the phone with her? She knows the concept, but sort of talk through the specific problem with her. And then what we do is we say, you know what, no matter where the conversation goes, one thing we want to make sure you highlight is, you know, fill in the blank, because that's what you are so good at. And you've got to make sure that everyone in the room hears that. And then where those conversations go from there, we normally have 3 or 4 broad talking points that, you know, to instigate, because there's always the question, whether you like it or not, you got to pose the question of like, okay, well, how are we going to pay for it?
Right.
If we want to change it, how are we going to pay for it? But other than that, once we instigate, that's where I like to fill up the wine glasses and the cocktail, right? And then you let people go.
Yes.
And it's really, really fun. I feel like I end up taking more notes than all the front end work of bringing the people together, because you just learn so much.
That's right. It's almost like, it kind of reminds me of sitting around at my, you know, I'm very Irish, as you know, because when you sit around and you just talk about what's happening, sometimes we get so entrenched in our own perspective that we don't know how to get rid of the blinders, how to, you know, broaden our seemingly narrow vision. And sometimes all it is just a word or a phrase or something that you viscerally feel about what someone is saying. And you go, oh, yeah, I can let my guard down. And that's where change starts to happen.
Yes. Well, and the one on security that I was just speaking of, I had one of those moments. I think a lot of people in the room did. And it was beyond the communication piece. We actually had a guy there who, I won't go into his technology, but ultimately he was responsible for something that was used when we got the first positive Ebola tests here in the United States. Mm. And he was the investor behind it. And when people said, well, we needed, you know, one of these, and that is hospital person, an emergency room doctor saying, we asked for 3 of those and you gave us 0. And the man said, you know, that one thing cost me, and he threw out this enormous number. And we all went, oh, what? And he said, I was the sole investor. He said, no one believed in this until it was too late. He said, we always said, if there's an outbreak of something, we're going to need this. He said, but no one else has stepped up to put the thought and energy and money behind creating it. He said, so we had 10 of them. And he said, so I'm sorry. Yes, your hospital is the closest to my house. But by the time you called, we had 4 positive Ebola tests and the other 6 were deployed to places right there. You know,
wow.
So that if, you know, and he said, so we didn't have any more. Like, it wasn't about you or me or anything else. And we ended up having this wonderful, deep discussion around, unfortunately, pains and things. But how do you use technology and how do you plan, you know, for what if scenarios, and then who's responsible for paying for that? Because everyone in that room had blamed someone else for not being prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you put them down face to face and someone said, well, I paid for that out of my own bank account because I believed in it and I could only afford this many. And you saw these doctors and administrators pause and like, we had no idea.
Exactly. When you change someone's perspective, there's a beautiful term that's called measure, that I talk to a lot of people about. And measure is not the increments of inches or centimeters and millimeters. It's who are you in relation to anything? How do you measure up, but how do you see yourself in relation to something? And it's a really important term that it isn't about making a judgment. It's about, well, how is my measure affecting my perspective? And making it expand or making it narrow. And it's a really important thing. So we're going to take, we have one more minute in this segment, Nicole. So I want to just reintroduce you because I want to get into the whole other beautiful work that you're doing with the brain health. Again, my guest is Nicole Fisher. She's in Washington, D.C. She's a senior policy advisor on Capitol Hill and an expert on health innovation. And she is the founder and CEO of Health and Human Rights Strategies, and she works globally. And it's when we return, we're going to talk about the important work that she has done with brain health in relation to concussions and the NFL and all kinds of people that have, you know, really, we really need to look at what are we doing to ourselves and the long-term effect of brain trauma. So please stay with me. This is Elaine Grohman on Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, and we will continue with Nicole Fisher in just a moment. Please stay with us.
The Empower Meditation Channel. Nonstop meditation music 24 hours a day in the new Empower Radio app. Music to empower your meditation, help you relax, sleep, or provide a calm background while you work. The Empower Meditation Channel is interruption-free. Listen now with the Empower Radio app, free in the App Store, or listen online at empower.fm. Soothe your soul, calm your mind. The Empower Meditation Channel.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council. This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take this time to breathe deeply and close your eyes. Right now, you're completely in control. Unlike the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you tried removing those raccoons from the basement. Concentrate on the soothing sound of my voice. Release the memory of when you wrestled with that beehive in your son's treehouse. Let go of the time you thought that skunk was a cat, or when you pulled into the garage with your son's bike on top of the car. Deep breaths. Deep breaths.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Katie Couric. I've interviewed world leaders, CEOs, and celebrities, but my most important role has been as a mother. I've worked hard to encourage my two girls to believe in themselves. Girls with high self-esteem are better prepared to navigate life's challenges. So join me as we empower the next generation.
This message was brought to you by the Alliance for Women in Media and made possible through the support of Dove and the Dove Self-Esteem Fund, working together to help girls reach their full potential. To learn more, go to Dove.com.
Now back to Elaine Grohman and Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Welcome back to the show. This is Elaine Grohman, and yes, this is Going Beyond Medicine, and today I'm going to reintroduce my wonderful guest, Nicole Fisher, who lives in Washington, D.C. She is the CEO and founder of the Health and Human Rights Strategies, and she works, I don't know how she gets everything done because she's a writer. She is an advisor on Capitol Hill. She's just amazing. And with brilliance and with humility, she brings people together to help them to begin to think differently about their lives so that we can really make some changes in our world. So welcome back to the show, Nicole.
Thank you.
So could you please tell us about the work that you're doing as you run the nonprofit Global Health Brain Health Coalition, and what that is doing to help to bring information about the immediacy and the long-lasting effects of brain trauma?
Yeah, well, this is a lifelong passion of mine. And I think the world is coming to a place where I sort of described it as all the Venn diagrams for me are coming together. They're all just converging upon each other. Mm. So when I was undergrad in college, I thought, and I wanted to be the world's greatest neurosurgeon. And so I was psychology and biology, double major. And I thought, I'm going to go to medical school and I'm going to, you know, work on people's brains and change the future. Well, you know, what hit me about my senior year was the real likelihood was that I was going to be in the middle of a medical school class, and I was going to be an average doctor who cared a lot, and I was going to end up writing prescriptions. And, you know, especially this late, you know, 90s, early 2000s, and all big pharma. And I panicked. And I said, I don't want to do that. I want to change the healthcare system. I want to help a lot of people at once. Mm-hmm. And there's a small part of me that I want to change the world, but I don't know how to do that. So I started doing lots of international health work, and I got a master's in policy. And during that entire time, I worked in either emergency departments volunteering or in centers for neuroscience. And in Chicago, where I happened to move, there is all kinds of great work being done on the brain. And I ended up in a lab with these spectacular women who were looking at everything from aging and Alzheimer's to actually HIV and what happens to a woman who has HIV. She goes through menopause many years earlier than she should. So her brain is triggering something in her body. And I've just been fascinated my whole life by the brain. And, you know, President H.W. Bush declared the 1990s the decade of the brain and was certain that from 90 to 99, we were going to solve all these problems by learning how the brain worked. Well, you know, 30 years have gone by and we still don't have many answers at all. But we with technology are right on the cusp of seeing really how the brain works. We can see when the first neurons fire. We can see, you know, what areas light up when people do certain things. We know risk and reward behaviors. And so I really think we're at that point. And I was doing a series of talks around sort of earlier we talked about health in all policies and how I think all public policy should be made thinking about healthcare. Well, I really, if you dig even deeper into that, I really believe at the end of the day, we're going to come to a place where brain health is public health. Because how we heal, how we think, what you and I were talking about earlier, where we live, who we interact with, the way our brain absorbs that information is our health.
That's
right. It's who we are. It's how we respond. It's how we cope. It's how we sleep, which, you know, is when we regenerate so much. And so I, with a group of other people, came together and we used to do events around brain health. And we decided that this sort of, I don't want to call it a platform, but this issue, many issues around the brain needed a platform. And in things like cancer, you know, we have the American Cancer Society and all the cancers fit under that. Well, we don't have that for the brain. We have an Alzheimer's Association. We have, say, the Michael J. Fox, you know, Foundation for Parkinson's. We've got all these disparate little organizations. They're all competing for attention and money. And yet we can't give a lot of deliverables. But I think to the example I just used, cancer, we used to call it cancer. Now we know there are 8 distinct kinds of breast cancer. And there are probably many more, but that's, you know, how far we've come with science.
Right.
The brain is the same way. Right now we say, well, you have a brain injury. Right. In the near future, we're gonna know so much more. We won't use words like concussion because it doesn't mean much more than, well, you've got some trouble up there.
Right.
And so we created this nonprofit and we used brain health very broadly and coalition because the goal wasn't to become one of these other competing nonprofits. says, give us your money. We're going to do more research or better research. The goal is to start bringing people together and saying, anyone who's doing work in the brain space and trying to make brains healthier deserves recognition, attention, and we all need to be learning from one another.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. Well, and technology is making that possible, but it's cliched to say, but people always talk about how there's silos in healthcare. And I can tell you that in neuroscience, we're the worst because so much of the technology is new, right? The intellectual property is new, proprietary. No one wants to share. And people will say like, oh, you should, you know, get us some attention because we're doing this cool thing. I'm like, well, you have to tell me about this cool thing. Like, well, we can't share anything with you. You just have to trust us. It's amazing. Mm. Like, well, that's not really sharing. That's not how that works.
That's right.
And so we've got all these people competing, trying to do similar things when we should be working together. And so we've partnered, really almost been absorbed by this broader nonprofit that was Brain Treatment Foundation. And the goal is really to help people, as we learn more and more, to bring, whether it's practitioners together, whether it's to bring patients together. You pick your topic. I mean, so many of our, even the doctors that are involved, are not MDs, they're DOs, because they're looking at eye movement, you know, and they're able to say, like, we think the area of injury is here and here, because of the way they respond in the following, you know, sight or vision and hearing are really the ones that are fascinating. And so our goal is to bring all these people together when appropriate and then help people get treatment. And it's really rewarding. Almost everyone that's gone through the treatment programs, they're very specialized. So it's not like we have one treatment program. And we send mostly military veterans, a few active people, some retired athletes, and a few victims from domestic violence. And we send them through to get holistic treatment for their brain injuries, but then to also help them rebuild their lives.
Mm. It's so important because we humans are so, we don't even really understand our own potentials. But when we do let those potentials be seen, as we begin to understand neuroplasticity and how the brain has the capacity to redirect the neurons and the neural pathways in order to make something else function where the other maybe is limited or challenged in some way. And there is so much. And as you said, Nicole, it's so beautiful because when we realize that every single thought within us is creating a chemical response. So that chemical response is either helping us to see what's in front of us or to have a cognitive thought or to be able to tell our body how to digest the food we just ate. You know, so there's so many things that is we need to look at in such a broader way. And I think it's so wise of you that you use the term coalition. Because if we don't disseminate this information and we don't realize, we're all in this life together. So we can't be so proprietary necessarily about who owns what, because none of us really own our life. We've been given our life.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's wonderful. And we've been given a great platform and I'll use the word ironic, although that's probably the wrong word, but sport is the platform we've used. And it's because of the traction that we could get. And I mean that both good and bad. So the NFL, I think many of us know, has gotten a lot of attention about concussion, broadly speaking.
Yes.
And the negative attention has come in the fact that, you know, they've been accused of trying to bribe the National Institutes of Health. They've been hiding data. Some of us think it looks almost identical to the pun intended playbook of big tobacco 30 years ago. But at the same time, it's a sport that America loves. And it's not going away just because some people are injured or we're learning it's not as above board as we once thought it was. And so using sport as the platform to talk about these other issues has actually been a gift. And And so I always feel torn when people say like, oh, you must hate, you know, the NFL. And I say, no, I don't. And I actually love football. And I know many, many football players. But I say, you know, it's just like any other muscle in the body. You know, there are people who can go, I actually know some people who played football, you know, college, high school, college, professional, and were in the NFL for 15 years, and they're absolutely brilliant. They're retired, they're professional photographers, they've got MBAs, they're doing all this amazing work with no signs of injury. You have other people, you know, they go out and they play one game, they take one hard hit, and they actually die.
Yeah.
And we see this with other organs as well, right? We see people who can take all kinds of, you know, be in a terrible car accident, be told they're paralyzed for the rest of their lives, and they learn to walk again. Yes. You know, other people can have one small injury or a bacterial infection, and they are paralyzed for the rest of their lives. And so, you know, it's not fair to say that this one thing is so evil. I think the real assessment is, you know, there are people who have done this. Their propensity for being injured and having, you know, long-term negative effects is much greater. So we need to understand why, and we need to make changes that protect sports, particularly children.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But it's like we've got to find, as with so many things in life, we've got to find that gray area where, you know, we're human beings. We love competition. We love sport. Just because we get rid of one doesn't mean it's not going to express itself in some other way. And so what we need to do is learn how to be safe doing the competitive things we love. And I think we're really close. I think neuroscience is getting us closer and closer to that point.
So, Nicole, do you find that you're having more and more people that are wanting to be involved in this Global Brain Health Coalition? I would imagine you have, you know, medical schools and institutions of health, as well as you say, the term silos, those who are looking specifically at particular events that happen, whether it's a traumatic brain injury or PTSD or mm-hmm. Parkinson's, everyone's more coming together. Is that what you're telling us?
A little bit. You were just starting to see it. And I'm hoping that everything you just said is right. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that in the next few years, we start to see a real momentum shift. In fact, you don't know this, but you and I always sort of click in these magical ways. It's actually the goal of my dissertation. I'm finishing my doctorate right now, and I'm writing a dissertation, and I meant to do it just on neuroscience and sort of where public policy is going. That thing has shifted again, as all good dissertations do, I suppose. But now the outcome I'm really looking at is how public-private partnerships can drive the future of science and policy. And the goal is everything you just said. It's, you know, what is that, if we can find one, what is that sweet spot of bringing people together that moves things forward in a way that allows technology to, you know, get to people quickly, allows research to, you know, run wild, and yet protects people on the moral sort of compass that we believe in. And so I'm actually, instead of obsessing over neuroscience to finish my dissertation, I'm obsessing over partnerships.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because as you're saying this, so much of my great privilege that I've had to work with Native American elders is that we have a brain, but we forget that we also have a mind. And our mind is not the same as our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can change our mind, we actually start to function with a whole different kind of brain. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. So I just, oh my gosh, after this phone call, I have so much to talk to you about.
Yeah. It's like, we need another hour. Yes. Well, I think even medicine, I think this is such a cool place to be. And one of the questions I posed a while back to some people, the question was posed to me around pharmaceuticals and depression. And then I countered and said, do you think we'll come to a place where now that we know we can, as you're talking about neuroplasticity, now that we know we can retrain our brain and those pathways that tell us, you know, like you were talking about digesting food, right? Those pathways are so well worn, we don't think about it. It does it for us, right?
That's right.
But oftentimes when people get depressed or they go into these dark places, they're each time they're there, right? Those pathways that go down that, we'll just, you know, vaguely call it a negative path, but those get more well-worn, more well, right? And they become easier. It becomes easier for the neurons to go down that pathway. And so I've questioned, like, do you think there will come a point that instead of writing a prescription, we give people, you know, thought exercises on positive thinking, and so that we make sure that that pathway, the positive one, is more well-worn than the negative one. And that's how we start to treat people. And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it's a combination of both. I have no idea. But I just, what you were saying got me thinking about the conversation we were having with a group of people about, can you train yourself to get through your own problems with exercises?
You know, I'm glad you're saying this, because a friend of mine is a neurologist here in Michigan. She's a remarkable woman. And she actually prescribes happiness. She will literally write a prescription.
Really?
Smile as often as possible today. And what we recognize is we don't give ourselves permission, unless it comes from, quote unquote, an authority figure, to actually enjoy ourselves, to give ourselves the opportunity to change our mind. Well, wouldn't that be a wonderful, you know, experience to see? Well, you know, go out and skip around your block today, you know, if you're able.
What are you doing? Like, my doctor told me to.
Yeah, that's right. I have a prescription. You want to see it?
My doctor says I have to skip around. That's great.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just, we have so many mindsets that we think we have to follow. And when we give ourselves permission to think differently, it's a whole other ball game, isn't it?
It is. And everything about us comes from that. And so we started broadly talking about, you know, the healthcare system, and it's all things, and health, and then into the brain. And it also got me thinking, I mean, you can see there's a really cool study, and I can't remember who did it, but they were looking at children and how they process words. And it was comparing kids. I'm going to get this so wrong, but I want to say they were looking at kids who live in like Delaware or New Hampshire versus children that live in like LA. And they were saying that the way children process words is, I mean, similar, right? It's the same part of the brain, but completely different. Mm-hmm. Because almost all the children they were looking at in the Northeast read books, or their parents read books, or they had newspapers around. And so they were very alert and attuned to black and white print. And their word choice and selection was very much based around that. And then they were looking at the brains of children in the Southwest, if it was LA, and they saw words in color. And they were saying it's because of all the magazines and billboards and graffiti and like all the different, just the presentation of words was
Isn't
very different, and that you could see how children learned, and to all the things we've been talking about, you know, to start at such a young age and say, well, yes, all children are learning words, but some of them see it in black and white print, others see it in color. So your brain is actually structured differently to see words and process words and experience words, and then that follows you for the rest of your life.
That's right. And then when we take things literally, I'm recalling a cute little conversation when my son was a little boy. A friend was saying that she had a little boy in the back seat in the car, and he said, "Mommy, I have to go potty," and she said, "Well, yeah, you'll have to hold it," and he said, "I can't. It'll go through my hands." You know, I mean, just literal. How can I hold it? But we don't realize how things are so, we either take things literally, or we have no idea what somebody's even talking about. So we create from our own experience and so easily misunderstand things.
Yes. And so I just thought, think of the implications that carry out when teachers are teaching. And just to your point, they could say one thing and a child somewhere takes it in a certain way. A child. And then all of a sudden we say, well, they didn't understand this well. I say, well, in their way, they did. They completely understood it in the context of how.
Of their language.
Of their language, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I really think that we in the future will think about ourselves and our interactions with other people in the world around us through our brains, through how we, or to your point, the difference between the brain and thought.
Yes.
I hope we get there, maybe in our lifetime.
Well, you know, somebody's got to start somewhere, honey.
you started this earlier by saying people aren't very good at change. We don't like change.
But we are here to change.
But we are here to change.
Every moment is changing. So when we look at that, and I think that so many people are afraid of change because they have to give up in their mind what they think that they have fought for. So they think that they have fought for a particular thing, but actually we're fighting for awareness. And when we're aware, then everything is, we can have a different measure about everything instead of being limited by a prescribed way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. So I want to also ask you, Nicole, and again, my guest is Nicole Fisher of the Health and Human Rights Strategies, which is hhrstrategies.com. So please look at her website because there's so much that she's doing. And she also writes for Forbes magazine, and there's so many different things that you're doing. But in particular with human rights, Nicole, I think that, you know, here in Michigan and globally, there's such an important awareness, again, to use that term, of human trafficking and the problems that are so evident in how women in particular, but not just women, because certainly any human can be trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
But how are you opening the doors for that kind of discussion? Because I know that you've been working on that as well.
So that's really a global health question. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how often I get disappointed. And I hate to use that word, but I really get disappointed when, so I do write and speak a lot. And I'll talk about something like trafficking. And people say, well, yeah, but that's not healthcare. And to what we've been saying this whole hour is, you know, everything is healthcare. And I say, honestly, human trafficking is a cornerstone of global health.
Absolutely.
And it's such a difficult thing to tackle because, well, of all the things we talked about, part of it is mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And these are really, really vulnerable people. And in the United States, we have this we're often presented with information the wrong way about what trafficking is. And I think we often visualize some like Russian girl who's tied up in a basement and it's sex trafficking, when that it does exist. But in reality, trafficking is so many things. And it, here in the United States, it's in every zip code. And it's often labor trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
I think in there's a county in Southern California. The estimate from last year was that 33% of people that lived in that county had their passports taken away or whatever form of documentation. And the point of that example is that these are people who at some point had immigrated, and legal immigrants were American citizens, but at some point had their documentation taken away. And so they were fearful that no one would believe them, that they were American citizens and that they had, you know, gone through the right process. They had lived here. They had children here. And so 33%, a third of this community was working basically as indentured servants. And they didn't have their own identification. I mean, completely beholden to a few other individuals who basically owned them. And labor trafficking exists. The mainly construction is one of the absolute worst. Farming.
Yes.
In certain parts of this country. Yeah. You know, lots of jobs. Again, you know, people think of immigration. You often hear about, you know, a woman working as a maid in a hotel. No, actually, it's, you look to sectors like farming and construction.
That's right.
And we're doing a lot. The UN, you know, the UN does a lot of good. They often get it wrong sometimes, but they're facilitating a lot of ways to combat trafficking. And technology is actually enabling this in terms of hiring practices. Construction firms can now look towards all kinds of different softwares and apps, apps on phones that can help confirm who people are and get them out of trafficking.
Nicole, excuse me, but unfortunately, we're kind of running out of time, so we're going to have to bring this discussion at another time, because I did in the past and had an amazing woman on who had been a human trafficking victim here in Michigan and literally was a slave across the street, and she was a young, affluent young woman, and people just didn't realize it happens across the board. So it's, again, changing our minds so that we can actually use our brains in a different way. So again, my guest has been Nicole Fisher of Health and Human Rights Strategies in Washington, D.C. Please take a look at her website, hhrstrategies.com. Learn about what she's doing. Open your own mind and your own heart to see the things that we can do globally to help to change our world for the better for every human that is here and all humans for the future. Thank you so much for your time, Nicole.
Thank you.
I appreciate you very much.
I appreciate you, and I always learn so much when I talk to you.
Well, thank you, darling. Have a good day.
You too.
And this is Elaine Groman for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. Please go out, make it a good week. Don't forget, you too can make a difference every day. Thank you.